The deadline for getting on the ballot in Texas comes and goes with the list of candidates may or may not tell us about an evolution in Texas politics. That story today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Years ago, alarm bells sounded over a high rate of maternal mortality in the Lone Star State. Then the data was found to be problematic. A new investigation suggests it was right to be concerned after all. We'll hear why. And a booming business in craft distilling in Texas, but spirits unusually low over a coming change. All those stories and a whole lot more when the national news show of You Know Where gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 10th day of December 2019. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us as what might be described as impeachment week takes center stage in the national psyche, although it's probably fair to wonder who's still tuned in. We are, of course. Indeed, just this morning, House Democrats formally unveiled their articles of impeachment, charging the president with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The charges will be taken up by the Judiciary Committee later this week. And if all happens as expected, President Trump will stand trial in the Senate in early 2020. But a thought-provoking piece in the New York Times suggests it's as much truth itself that's on trial here. As Peter Baker notes, Mr. Trump is hardly the first dissembler-in-chief. LBJ, Nixon, and a certain former governor of Arkansas who was also impeached once upon a time come to mind. Baker quotes Peter Wenner, a Dallas native and longtime aide to both Presidents Bush, as saying, "We're in a dangerous moment right now, the danger being that people come to believe that no one is giving them the facts and everyone can make up their own script and their own narrative. And we do it every day on social media. We constantly mold ourselves to be as we wish others to see us. We've got plenty of practice reshaping narratives. It's just that trust was already a dwindling commodity in American public life. And after this latest chapter in the drama of the Trump era of American politics, there is likely to remain the question of whether trust in our institutions has been acquitted or impeached." Closer to home, a deadline in Texas for those hoping to win the support of voters to a variety of offices. Mark Jones is a professor of political science at Rice University. Dr. Jones, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
So from your bird's eye view, how are the Republican and Democrat Party primaries in Texas shaping up?
Well, they're incredibly competitive. We have just in the U.S. House alone for the 36 seats, for the first time in recent history, we have a Republican and a Democrat in every single one of the 36 districts. And we have over 225 competing across the board. So we have many Republican and Democratic primaries where we have 16, 17 candidates competing for just the one slot of nomination.
Does this work for voters, or is it you're dazzled by so many names, it's kind of hard to to pick among them?
Well, it makes it more difficult, especially when you're getting to 16 or 17, although there are top-tier candidates, second-tier candidates, and third-tier candidates, so it gets a little easier. And since we have a runoff system in Texas, if no one gets 50% plus right. One in March, the top two meet again in May, and that allows voters to at least, as between March and May, focus in on the two top candidates, and then they get to learn more about them.
This election cycle, Democrats are hopeful they can take over control of the Texas House. You think that's going to happen? How would they pull that off?
Well, right now, Texas Republicans have an 8-seat advantage. And mm-hmm. So Democrats need a net gain of 9 seats in 2020. And they've identified about 18 seats where they think they have a realistic prospect of defeating the Republican. Republicans, of course, have about 5 or 6 or 7 seats where they think they could defeat a Democrat. So we're going to see about 25 Texas House seats be the focal point. And that's not just going to be of interest here in Texas. We're going to see millions of dollars come in nationally as Democrats hope to flip the House to keep Republicans from having carte blanche in redrawing the congressional districts in 2021 after the 2020 census.
Do you get a sense that the Republicans on the ballot in Texas are taking the Democrats' optimism seriously?
Oh, very much so. Many Republicans were surprised in 2018, essentially caught asleep at the switch. That's not going to happen in 2020. So we see Republicans out trying to recruit top tier candidates, both to compete against Democratic incumbents or for seats where the Republicans have retired and therefore it's an open seat.
So as of last night, if I understand things correctly, you can't now squeeze yourself in on a ballot in Texas. That's the deadline was yesterday, correct?
That's correct. There'll be a small number of seats that if someone essentially who was a current incumbent withdrew, there would be a week grace period. But for pretty much everyone else, it's set. You can't get on the ballot again.
And I think some Democrats disappointed that former presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke did not decide to challenge John Cornyn, right?
Right. And I think that was pretty clear that Beto was not going to drop down and run for Senate, in part because there are a half dozen very credible Democratic candidates who are already running, and I think would have been quite upset with him had he done so.
What is there a kind of, I don't know, a galvanizing issue, person, candidate out there that may drive people to the polls? I mean, a lot of Democrats say they need someone to excite their base, and they were hoping that perhaps that Senate race would do it.
Well, I think if they're looking for that, they're going to have to look at the presidential ticket, because while the Democrats running against John Cornyn are all quite credible, I don't think any one of them is going to have the excitement wow factor that Beto provided in 2018. So for Democrats, in terms of mobilization, I think they're going to have to look at their presidential nominee to help them get people to the polls.
Mark Jones, political science professor at Rice University. Professor, thanks again for speaking with us.
No, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on The Standard.
In the span of 3 years, nearly 400 women in Texas died from health issues related to pregnancy or childbirth. This, according to a new investigation by the nonprofit newsroom ProPublica, which claims that while many causes for the state's high maternal mortality rate are similar to the causes of maternal mortality elsewhere in the U.S., here in the Lone Star State, a growing problem with health insurance access for women who can't afford it is also to blame. Nina Martin covers sex and gender issues for ProPublica. She and Julia Belews at Vox collaborated on this investigation. And Nina joins us now. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's focus on the numbers first. Track between 2012 and 2015. How does the rate in Texas compare with other states across the U.S. when it comes to health issues related to pregnancy or childbirth?
I think it's really difficult to calculate a rate because Texas's data has been notably problematic over the last few years. So Texas has had to calculate and recalculate and recalculate its data, and this is its most recent, most accurate, best data. Texas is the second largest state in the U.S. It has the second largest number of births, and it has, in terms of sheer numbers, the most maternal deaths. There's no question.
Well, I remember when this was first talked about, it must have been back around 2013, 2014, that time period here in Texas, there was a real hue and cry over the enormous maternal mortality rate, which was then scoped back because of what were described as clerical errors, data gathering, data collection errors. But it sounds like what you're suggesting is that the alarms first sounded were not for naught, that in fact something odd was happening here in Texas. And what is happening here?
Texas is a huge problem. And the problem is really about the sheer numbers of women who die from pregnancy-related causes. And the major contributing factor, according to the State Maternal Mortality Review Committee and some of the reporting that we've done, is lack of insurance or underinsurance, insurance gaps at really critical moments in a new mother's life. And I think a really important data point that's gotten very little attention until we were able to calculate it is late postpartum deaths. These are deaths that occur from 6 weeks to a year postpartum. And that really has to do with an insurance issue. The fact that many women on Medicaid lose their Medicaid, pregnancy Medicaid, it only lasts for 2 months postpartum.
Not to be thick about this, but I just want to sort of walk through this because some people may not understand how insurance could have such a devastating effect. If you are in need of medical service, I don't know of a hospital that's going to say, nope, we're not going to allow you to enter these doors. I mean, the hospitals will treat people who are uninsured, although this will obviously lead to and does lead to enormous medical bills on the backside of that. So how is the insurance issue having an effect on deaths related to pregnancy?
if you have an emergency, then you can go to the emergency room. And if you are admitted to the hospital, some part of that cost you may not have to pay. But if you're not admitted, they examine you and they give you pills and they give you tests and everything. They send you home, which is what usually happens to people. You're going to get a bill very often. If you're a woman like Diana Diaz, who was the lead woman that we talked about in our story, she worked for temp agencies. She worked for cleaning schools, working in factories. These are jobs that did not have insurance. And she had sort of chronic health issues over her life, including a stomach problems, gastritis. So when she started to have stomach problems, the last thing she wanted to do was to go to the emergency room because she thought, well, this is something that I've had before. And also, I can't afford it. And so what she didn't realize was that she was actually pregnant with a very dangerous condition called an ectopic pregnancy, where the fetus attaches itself to, in her case, the fallopian tube, and she bled out, and she, by the time she arrived in the hospital, she died. Another one is it takes a really long time in Texas to get pregnancy Medicaid, much longer than it does in, say, Oklahoma. 20% of women don't get their prenatal care until they are already in their second trimester. Another 10% don't start until they're in their third trimester. And that's tremendously dangerous to women and to babies.
That's the voice of Nina Martin. She covers sex and gender issues for ProPublica. She and Julia Belluz at Vox collaborated on an investigation examining how the lack of insurance among poor and middle-class women is contributing to Texas's high maternal mortality rate. Ms. Martin, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's find out what Texans are talking about. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, joins us now.
Hi, David. Hello. House Democrats have presented articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Social media abuzz with reactions on this historic day. Via Facebook, Gabrielle Gordon says, "No one is above the law. If Trump is innocent, he's had many opportunities to present evidence and witnesses. Instead, he decides to hide and bully. It is a sad day in American history," Gabrielle writes, "but next is the Senate, where I expect he will have his team protect him." Stephen Robinson says, "This was settled the day he went on live TV and asked Ukraine and China to investigate the Bidens. Conservatives and Republicans are willingly playing ignorant and overlooking this because they're completely bought in. They risk the Republic to save face." Meanwhile, Dale Smith calls the impeachment proceedings a distraction from the Democrats. Also hearing from folks about the story we just heard about the dangers of being pregnant and uninsured in Texas. Lots of reactions coming in about that story. I'll be back with more later in the show.
Let us know what's on your news radar, Texas. Tweet us right now at Texas Standard. Wells, be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a network of more than 460 physicians who deliver cancer-fighting treatments and compassionate care to more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
Business and your money on The Standard. It may be true that it's been a while since the Longhorn Nation has been entirely happy, but performance at the gift shop seems to be holding up. Newspapers across the nation taking note of a new product licensing deal that the Regents of the University of Texas approved yesterday. It's estimated to bring in some $100 million to the school. This partnership with Collegiate Licensing is a re-up of an old partnership after the Longhorns allowed a previous contract to expire in 2016 so that the university could bring it all in-house and not have to divvy up the dollars. This new deal runs through 2032, making Collegiate the exclusive licensing agent for the Texas name, the Longhorn logos on coffee mugs, jackets, t-shirts, and I suppose championship pennants too, should the need arise. Texas ended their regular season 7-5, landing a slot in the Alamo Bowl against Utah on New Year's Eve.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The publication Total Retail is reminding consumers it's the most wonderful time of the year for hackers. And with the holidays representing as much as 20% of all retail activity, 'tis the season indeed. But how well do we heed such warnings about hackers? In the healthcare industry, hacking can be a matter of life or death. But as Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav reports, despite a decades-old effort to secure pacemakers, CT scanners, patient heart monitors, and other potentially vulnerable medical devices, dangers still abound.
Jay Radcliffe got up on a stage at the Black Hat Cybersecurity Conference in 2011 and hacked his own insulin pump.
So you can kind of see the impact of this, right?
I wrote a program that was able to turn off my insulin pump and change the therapy settings without the user knowing it.
The type 1 diabetic was diagnosed at age 22 and showed how a bad guy could really mess him up.
You know, if an evil hacker hacked my pump in the crowd here, he could give me insulin right now, without my authority.
At the time, very few had shown how lax the security of these devices were.
And it turned into this very, very big thing.
For years, device manufacturers assumed doctors and technicians would be the only ones interested. Radcliffe says manufacturers weren't prepared for outsiders saying, hey, you got a problem here.
They weren't very responsive. They didn't return my phone calls. They didn't know what to do. They didn't have a process or procedure. If there's no process, it's kind of paralysis.
Companies could threaten hackers with lawsuits when they exposed vulnerabilities. It was so bad that many in the field thought something dire would have to happen before things changed. Here's Joshua Corman, ethical hacker and co-author of a 2017 Congressional Health Security Report at CyberMed Summit last month.
They said, guys, I'm not going to lie to you. People will have to die first. No one's going to listen until we have our first confirmed kills.
So, 73-year-old male, he's got left-sided weakness, right-sided facial droop.
Medical personnel led by Dr. Rahul Nene worked to help Patrick, who's been paralyzed on his left side for 3 hours.
So we're going to start with a CAT scan of your head. I'm worried that you may be having a stroke.
Then disaster strikes.
Attention clinicians, we are experiencing an
unexpected... CT scanner along with several other critical systems are taken offline by what Dr. Nene will later learn is a ransomware attack.
Oh, that's going to make things a little bit more difficult.
I don't know what's going on.
The doctor thinks Patrick is having a stroke, and the one test that would have told him what to do is offline. Every minute he goes without treatment, his oxygen-starved brain is dying. Fortunately, this is just a simulation. Everyone other than Dr. Nene knew a cyber attack was coming. Now the resident has to work through how to treat the actor patient.
Because they can't take care of this patient, they actually have to transfer them to another hospital. Again, this is wasted minutes.
Dr. Christian Demeff narrates the scene to a couple hundred doctors, medical device manufacturers, and cybersecurity professionals watching on two enormous screens upstairs, live at the University of California, San Diego. It's meant to show how reliant doctors are on technology, especially internet-connected devices that can be hacked, and how ill-prepared they are for worst-case scenarios. There are currently no deaths linked to medical device hacking, but as the demonstration showed, we might not know if there was.
Doctors and nurses don't know about it and are not looking for it. Hospitals do not have the security resources and expertise that they need to even detect some of these attacks. Device manufacturers have little incentive to do deep forensic analysis because it may result in a huge issue with them.
He says the healthcare industry often only thinks about cybersecurity in terms of data breaches and HIPAA fines, which will cost providers $4 billion this year. The threat from medical devices is less from bad guys and more from unintended malware that slows devices down and endangers patients, he says. Things like 2017's WannaCry ransomware attack that crippled a third of hospitals in the UK.
You know, I don't think there's an army of psychopath hackers out there that are ready to do that. Instead, I think we have a far more boring but realistic threat to patient safety and human life in this regard. It's unintentional spillover effects.
The FDA didn't wait for someone to get hurt to act. Prompted by regulatory changes, manufacturers have increased cybersecurity in the field. It's better on new devices, though some would argue it's still too low. Security patches are available for many old ones. While manufacturers may be on the right track, what about hospitals?
We're years behind the attackers in many cases when it comes to identifying these vulnerabilities and patching these devices.
Adam Nunn has worked in hospitals for 23 years, now working as a consultant for Clearwater Compliance. Even when companies do have updates for products, average hospitals have tens of thousands of connected devices. And Nunn says most hospitals can't keep up with security updates because they have no cybersecurity person on staff.
You remember the old cartoons where there's a dam and somebody's trying to plug the holes in the dam and just holes just keep opening up. It's kind of what it's like.
Suzanne Schwartz is Deputy Director of the Office of Strategic Partnerships and Technology Innovation for the FDA. She calls these older legacy devices the last mile problem because they were so expensive and can be hard to update.
The legacy challenge is an extraordinary challenge because of the many factors that are involved, economics being a significant one.
The FDA wants more power to mandate increases in cybersecurity with devices and require they collect more data. Many have talked about a cash for clunkers program to incentivize hospitals to toss their legacy devices. For now, the agency's pushed a collaborative approach and gotten manufacturers to actually listen to hackers, which results in real device fixes. Just this summer, hackers and manufacturers worked together to show that more than a million drug infusion pumps could be taken over remotely. That's a far cry from 8 years ago, she says, when security researchers felt they had to get on a stage
and do a live demo of a hack in order to get the attention and to get some action from a manufacturer. We're in a very, very different place now.
But most Americans don't know much about this issue. And Jay Radcliffe says consumers of medical devices aren't likely to be able to keep up.
Companies with big budgets can't keep laptops up to date on a current basis. How are the consumer or a patient supposed to keep up with patching their refrigerators, their toothbrushes, their pacemakers, their insulin pumps? It's a very daunting challenge.
Radcliffe, who now works for a medical device company, says the risk is still well outweighed by the reward with his insulin pump and many other devices.
You know, yes, there's some risk, you know, but ultimately when I look at my health, you know, I can't not get these tests. I can't not have these treatments.
Unlike a lot of patients in the U.S., he at least is doing it aware of those risks. In San Antonio, I'm Paul Flav for the Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro is calling on the Trump administration to provide migrants detained at the U.S.-Mexico border with flu vaccinations. At a press conference this morning, the Democrat condemned the treatment of 16-year-old Carlos Gregorio Hernandez Vasquez, who died from the flu earlier this year while in federal custody in South Texas.
So this is a matter of life and death, whether the administration is willing to administer this flu shot. We're calling on the administration to act humanely to preserve these people's lives.
In the past year, at least three detained children have died from flu-related causes. Castro is sponsoring a bill that would require federal officials report and investigate all migrant deaths that occur under their watch. Texans have less than 1 week to buy health insurance through the online marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act. According to federal figures, more than 400,000 Texans purchased plans on healthcare.gov in the first month of enrollment, which began November 1st. Melissa McChesney is with the Center for Public Policy Priorities, a progressive think tank. She says most people qualify for financial assistance.
Almost 9 out of 10 consumers last year that purchased a plan on healthcare.gov got some level of assistance in paying their premiums.
The deadline to get a plan is Sunday. 1.1 million Texans signed up during the last enrollment period. Environmental groups are protesting a Trump administration plan to roll back new limits on methane emissions from oil and gas operations. As KUT's Mose Bouchel explains, a new online tool highlights how the change could impact local air quality, including in counties throughout Texas.
Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. The Environmental Defense Fund developed a map that purports to show the location of active oil and gas wells across the country. It allows users to zoom in and view estimates of how much methane and so-called volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, may be released by those wells under current rules and under the Trump proposal. Rosalie Wynn is a lawyer with the EDF. She says the proposed rollback would preempt future regulation of hundreds of thousands of existing oil and gas wells.
So, for example, in Travis County, if the you know, Trump administration is successful in preventing any future regulation of existing sources, VOC emissions over the next, you know, decade will spike.
Wynn says if the final rule looks like the proposal, environmental groups will likely sue to block it.
Mose Bouchel reporting. Space company Blue Origin has postponed a rocket launch in Van Horn, Texas this morning due to weather conditions. The company says it will try again tomorrow. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves, but drink with others. SierraNevada.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. High spirits for the holidays. Right now, Texas is seeing a boom in craft distilleries, small volume makers of whiskey, vodka, gin, and such. 15 years ago, there were just 3 distilleries in the Lone Star State. Today, it's 158. But now, some distillers say they are facing a potential setback that could cripple their ability to grow and even put some fledgling producers out of business. The Standard's Shelley Brisbane reports.
Y'all hear that sound? That thumping? Yeah. That's a mash being pumped over there out of the fermentation room through that metal pipe right up there going right into the still house. That's the sound of money around here.
Making and selling whiskey means telling stories. That's Scooter Pierce's job at Garrison Brothers Distillery in High Texas, just outside Fredericksburg. Whether it's a yarn about a colorful moonshiner of the past or how a corporate type chucked a steady job to make bourbon, consumers seem to want their locally produced booze to come with tall tales, especially in Texas. And smart distillers do their best to oblige, from Texas-centric marketing on the bottle to tours of the stillhouse. All of it is peppered with stories about the stuff in the bottle and the people who make it.
If you notice the black stuff here growing on the silos, that stuff there is called whiskey malt or bourbon malt. Back during the days of Prohibition, that's how they would bust the moonshiners or the people making bourbon, because their barns would turn black.
Pierce and the rest of the team practice their storytelling for tour groups visiting the working cattle ranch where Garrison Brothers Bourbon is made. But lately, craft distillers like Garrison have been telling a different kind of story to a much different crowd. Lawmakers in Washington. Texas distillers want Congress to make permanent a tax break that has become vital to their business.
In 2020, if this tax reduction doesn't continue, we can expect an increase in our taxes of several hundred thousand. And for a startup business, is a, you know, very vulnerable spot to be in.
That's Joanna Salinas, co-founder of Still Austin, a distillery that's been making whiskey at a South Austin office park for 2.5 years. She's talking about the lower tax rate craft distillers received as part of the Trump administration's 2017 tax package. Next month, that tax rate expires and will rise dramatically.
For a company like ours, everything is about whiskey and barrels. And so the money that we saved in not having to pay those taxes went directly into producing more product.
As it stands now, all distillers pay just under $3 per gallon of excise tax on the first 100,000 proof gallons they sell. That's a lot more spirit than craft distillers bottle in a year. But next month, the tax returns to more than $13 per gallon, and craft distillers say that puts them at a disadvantage. Larger industrial distillers like Beam Suntory, the company behind the Jim Beam and Maker's Mark brands, bottle far more each year and can shoulder that tax burden better.
A company like Beam Suntory can pull 100,000 gallons out by the end of January.
Mark Gillespie hosts and produces WhiskeyCast, a podcast that covers the spirits industry. He says beer and wine producers both have a tiered taxing system that actually helps smaller producers. The push to get Congress to make the distillers' lower tax rate permanent has been going on for quite a while.
Well, distillers have been arguing for this pretty much for the last decade. Basically, distilled spirits is the one area where they did not have a tiered system that helped smaller producers or gave them a break. The beer brewers had a tiered excise tax system so that smaller brewers didn't pay as much as the big guys did, and the same thing in the wine category.
Small distillers are backing a proposal called the Craft Beverage Modernization and Tax Reform Act, which would make the lower tax rate permanent. The bill has 326 House sponsors, 73 in the Senate.
The problem is you have this bill that's pending. It's been sitting in committee all year long in both the House and the Senate. They want to attach it to a bill that has a good shot at passage. It's one of these must-pass bills, like an appropriations bill or like a budget resolution.
Half of the Texas delegation in Congress have signed on as co-sponsors, but neither U.S. Senator John Cornyn or Ted Cruz is on that list. Their offices did not provide their position on the bill when we asked. There are must-pass bills remaining on Congress's calendar, including a budget resolution that's needed to avoid a government shutdown. But Washington is also distracted by impeachment, and plenty of other beneficiaries of the 2017 tax law want a shot at making their temporary tax breaks permanent. But so far, getting that commitment before time runs out on New Year's Eve might be a long shot. For the Texas Standard, I'm Shelley Brisbane.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, one of 17 U.S. universities with a land grant, sea grant, and space grant designation. Texas A&M University, fearless on every front. More at fearlessfront.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
So my name is Molly Birch, and I live in Austin, Texas, and I'm a singer-songwriter, and I just put out a Christmas album, and it's called the Molly Birch Christmas Album.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can count on me.
Always wanted to do it. I just think it's a really classic thing for a vocalist to do. I mean, I'm still a new artist. I've put out two original albums, even though it is a little unusual to put out a full Christmas album when you're not like a huge pop star at a certain point in your career. To me, I like that because it felt like really bold. We have a lot of classic standards on the album and then some were brand new to me and challenges. Like we have an ABBA song on the album and that was a big challenge vocally and just, yeah. But it's just so fun. I love ABBA. So I was like, this has to be on the record.
Happy New Year, Happy New Year.
There was a couple people that I just asked like, recommendations, and my sister had sent me this playlist. Then two of the songs on it was the ABBA song, Happy New Year, and Snow Queen of Texas.
I never meant you any harm. I'm on my knees, your majesty, Snow Queen.
I love the Mamas and the Papas, I love that song. And it just felt like a cute little nod to like me living in Texas, Snow Queen.
Texas left Paris in a cloud of smoke.
I wrote two songs for the album and then the rest are covers. So it's 10 covers and two originals. You know, I treated the album just like I would my own album with recording and the amount of time I've thought about it and like how much it took over my life.
It's the holiday season. I'm dreaming for this reason of you.
And this past year I've been touring too, my last album, but even on tour I was working on it, or like we did this Midwest tour and I would go to Goodwill's to find props for the cover because I wanted it to be this very like in your face Christmassy, like, so I'd be like in Kentucky, like at the Goodwill, I literally ran into someone that was coming to my show with like a handful of like wreaths. They were like, what are you doing? It's June. Yeah, it's been Christmas since my whole year. It really has. It's been great.
For outland.
Hi, this is Molly Birch, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texans who celebrate Christmas have all sorts of different holiday traditions. One differentiator, I suppose, is the tree. Some go artificial, some get one from a tree lot, and others like to go and chop one down themselves. Texas isn't exactly known for being a winter wonderland, but there are enough Christmas tree growers in Texas to form a Texas Christmas Tree Growers Association, and Francis Frederick is its current president. Mr. Frederick, thanks so much for taking some time out of what I know is one of the busiest times of your year.
Not a problem, sir.
How's it looking out there in, what do they call it? They don't call it the tree patch, I don't suppose. What do they call that, a tree farm?
Tree farm.
How's it looking out there?
Well, we actually sold out Saturday.
Good night. So demand is high. Is this saying something about supply this year?
Not necessarily. The demand for the live tree has gone up over the last, probably 8-9 years,
mm-hmm.
Since the recession in 2009.
I see. I have to say, I was sort of hinting at this from the beginning. Now, I've actually cut my own Christmas tree just a little bit east of Austin once upon a time. It was loads of fun. But I think a lot of listeners may be surprised to know that Christmas trees are grown in a place like Texas. I mean, and that you have enough Christmas tree growers that you have an association of them.
Yes, sir. We have right now just over 100 members of the association.
Wow.
There are other farms that are not members of the association, though.
Now, what kinds of Christmas trees tend to grow well in Texas?
East of 35, you have the Virginia pine, which is about most of what are grown there. There are some Leland cypress, and then also some Carolina sapphire and Arizona ice, and those two are a bluish green tree. And then you get west of 35, you typically see the Afghan pine or blue-eyed Erica is the proper name for that. And then some of the guys out there that irrigate quite a bit do have some of the Lelands out there also.
You know, I think a lot of folks, they see the lots up and they certainly go, you know, they go to HEB and pick out a tree. And there's this idea that what you're getting is sort of a Texas tree. I gather that's not the case.
That is not. I don't know of any tree grower in association that sells to a lot. Most of them are choose and cut farms. And they want the people to come out for the traditions and experience and memory of cutting a tree with the family.
Now, let me ask you, because I know this is high season and you've sold out, which has got to be great for the bottom line. But how tough is it the rest of the year? How do you sort of keep the the money flow going, as the banker might say?
We actually work full year because we start planting in January, replanting. And then you have to fertilize in March, and then you trim in May. And then, of course, you take care, make sure no insects or fungus or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you trim again in October, last part of October. And then, of course, you get ready for fall then. And some of the farms also have a pumpkin patch in October.
Right.
And then some of them do a Easter egg hunt for Easter.
I hear some of your trees have been celebrities, that you've had some in the Capitol building and the governor's mansion. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Every year the president gets to take some trees to the Capitol and the governor's mansion. And they've been doing that, I think, for 20 years.
That's pretty cool. You must probably get questions from folks who are sort of concerned about chopping down their own tree and what that means for the environment. What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them that, it's nice thing to do, that you get that tradition and experience, and we're always replanting right back after we cut down a tree. The way we do it is good for the environment, because then a lot of the places they take the tree and then they recycle them back into mulch.
Francis Frederick is president of the Texas Christmas Tree Growers Association. His farm is in Van Alstine, and though they're sold out for this holiday season, there are plenty of other Texas tree farms that you can check out. We'll have a link to their website at texasstandard.org. Mr. Frederick, thanks again and happy holidays.
You too. Thank you.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For decades, jailhouse informants have been presented as credible witnesses at criminal trials. In the movies, you've probably seen them called snitches. They take the witness stand and testify about what they say they've heard while they've been held in the same facility or even the same cell as the defendant. Using one jailed suspect to testify against another is perfectly legal, but the practice has come under more scrutiny recently. In Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Austin-based investigative reporter Pamela Koloff profiled one such man, Paul Skalnick. He's a fallen police officer who was frequently in and out of jails in Texas and Florida. His testimony as a jailhouse informant has helped send 37 people to prison and 4 people to death row in Florida. Pam, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Paul Skalnick started out as an Austin Police Department official in the 1970s. I guess he was a police officer. How did he end up in jail and as a career jailhouse informant?
He was very briefly an APD officer, but he quickly began writing hot texts and got in trouble with law enforcement. And the way that he would get out of trouble, he was charged 31 times over the course of the 70s and 80s and 90s, is he would claim to have overheard a confession of somebody he was jailed with, usually someone who was awaiting trial, who prosecutors very much needed to get a conviction with. And that was his sort of get out of jail free card.
Why is it that criminal courts consider jailhouse informants reliable? I mean, is some kind of corroboration to a jail suspect's testimony against another required?
In most states, corroboration is not required. In states where corroboration is required, it can be as simple as having another jailhouse informant confirm the facts that the first jailhouse informant said. Or as I found, many of the details that law enforcement or prosecutors were claiming were known only to them, and that the only way that Paul Skalnick could have obtained them was from the suspect in the case. They were actually basic details that if you read the newspaper or watched anything about the case on TV, you would be able to glean. And he used those details to weave together these very incendiary narratives that made juries want to convict.
Given that jailhouse informants in many situations have an incentive to, to use the vernacular, snitch on someone else in who might be behind bars, I'm a little surprised that more states aren't banning the use of jailhouse informants because of that self-serving aspect of such evidence.
Yes, and what's so interesting about that is that even when juries are informed of the fact that there's going to be a deal or some benefit to these witnesses, which often they are not, by virtue of the fact that prosecutors are putting these witnesses on the stand, that they're state witnesses, there's an implicit understanding by jurors that these are trustworthy witnesses because the state is putting them on there. And studies have shown even if jurors understand that there is a benefit that they're receiving, that sort of understanding that the state is sponsoring their testimony overcomes that.
That is really interesting. Okay, so Skalnick's testimony has led to 4 people serving on death row. What's the status
Correct.
Of their cases?
So only 2 of them are still on death row. The other 2 men were resentenced to life. The case that I focus on is the case of James Daly, who was convicted of a 1985 murder in Florida of a young girl, strictly on the word of his co-defendant, who all the evidence pointed to. And when that co-defendant refused to testify against him in court, they brought Paul Skalnick in, and he was sort of the closer for prosecutors, and he told this story that placed the murder weapon in James Daly's hands. And Mr. Daly had an execution date set of November 7th. There was a stay of execution that's in place through December 30th. After that, Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida can set a new execution date for him. And so my story explores the problems with that case.
We're going to have a link to it over at texasstandard.org. Pamela Koloff is a reporter for ProPublica and the New York Times Magazine. Pam, thanks so much for spending a couple of minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in the studio, social media editor Wells Dunbar. What are you hearing out there on the social medias?
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from folks about a story from earlier in the show, that months-long investigation from Vox and ProPublica delving into the extraordinary danger for the pregnant and uninsured in Texas, the death of nearly 400 pregnant or new mothers over the span of 3 years. Via Twitter, CMF tweets, "No mother should die because of a lack of insurance. Our state and country must be better than this, and thank you for covering the story." However, over on her Facebook page, JC Maxwell, she writes, "My son is 23 now, and I was an older first-time mom with a PhD and lots of preparation, information, and good doctors. Still, I had to advocate for myself much of the time, especially when I got into the hospital on a very busy weekend. I can only imagine what mothers with less education, less prenatal care, and fewer resources have to go through. It's a damn shame." And lastly, Matthias Moore, he writes, he calls out the what he describes as the twisted priorities of Texas government. It's like they weren't even elected by citizens, but by corporations, companies, and churches. So very eye-opening, provocative report there on a subject that we've been reporting on for quite some time here, and not alone in many Texas outlets covering that
story.
There
had been a lot of concern because early on there had been reports about a really high rate of maternal mortality in Texas. Then there was the controversy over the data. The state admitting or conceding that the data had not been correctly gathered. There had been a lot of problems with the gathering of the data. And some people, including the governor, saying, well, maybe this whole maternal mortality thing is not real.
Yeah, he pushed back on that, and I believe even accounting for some of those data errors, that still shows that Texas does have a higher rate, especially among African American and Hispanic mothers. Well, you know, speaking of state government, here's an interesting little tidbit that just came across the transom there. Greg Abbott, you know, his endorsement of an incumbent House Republican wouldn't usually be big news, but his latest endorsee isn't just anyone. It's Houston area Representative Sarah Davis. You may remember that Abbott unsuccessfully endorsed her primary challenger last election cycle, making for some sort of awkward moments there. Alluded to in the press release accompanying this endorsement, the governor's office writing, "State Representative Sarah Davis advocates for the needs and priorities of her constituents, and while we haven't always seen eye to eye, we share the same commitment," the statement reads in part. So very interesting turn of events here. Lots of folks pontificating online about what it might mean. Evan Smith there of the Texas Tribune, he writes via Twitter, "Now I've seen everything with this endorsement. All is forgiven, and by whom?" Two excellent questions there. Similarly, Jim Venturo tweets, "It would seem that the Texas governor endorsing Representative Davis is another sign the GOP is worried about that House majority in 2020.
I guess everyone's talking about impeachment today, but, you know, there is something that Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump agree on.
I know. I see you pulled it up there, and it is making some sort of interesting dichotomies there.
Texas is definitely squarely in view here. House Democrats praising a new trade deal to replace NAFTA amid the impeachment, just an hour after the articles of impeachment were released.
House Democrats press
said
conferences.
That they're going to back the president here, handing him a kind of victory on a campaign promise ahead of the 2020 election. There's going to be more on this and a whole lot more tomorrow, because we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we hope you'll join us then. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.